Welcome to the Garden Clinic podcast, Digs Deeper. I'm Linda Roth. Thanks for joining me today. I'm so excited to introduce you to my next guest, one that really needs no introduction. She is full of wonderful tips and tricks and a glorious gardener to boot.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.
My next guest was basically born in a nursery. Growing up in and around plants, she lives and breathes gardening, believing it's good for the mind, the body, and the spirit. It's Miss Sophie Thompson. She's a writer, speaker, and much-loved presenter on Gardening Australia. Sophie's mum to five children who live an idyllic childhood alongside nature and outdoors in the charming Adelaide Hills in South Australia, in a place called Hamlin Cottage, which is a large, sustainable, organic garden. It's these principles that she's now outlined in a beautiful, engaging new book called Sophie's Patch. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Sophie Thompson to the show. G'day, Soph.
Hi, Linda. Great to talk to you.
It's always lovely to chat to you, darling. What does Hamlin Cottage and Sophie's Patch mean to you?
Well, it's my home, and, you know, they say home is where the heart is. So it is my base. It's where I, you know, get my therapy. And, you know, it doesn't matter where we go around this beautiful country of ours, there is something special about coming home.
It's such a massive effort, it looks to me. You've been there for 11 years, and the idea was to feed your family as much as you can. So planting a veritable forest of fruit trees, 120 different types of citrus, and the menagerie of animals, of course, for eggs and so forth. It seems to me a full-time job.
Well, it would be lovely if it was. So we've owned this property for 7 years. So we rented here for a couple of years. And if I'd known I was going to buy, I would have started planting
earlier. Yes.
But, you know, the reality is I work a lot and, you know, more than full time, and I travel. And so it has to be sustainable in terms of me being able to maintain it. So it's certainly not a perfect garden. We've actually got a public event here over the next 3 days. And people will see weeds, they'll see frost damage and everything like that. But they'll also see a garden that feeds us and I'm passionate about, and it's showing that you can manage a 3-acre property without using herbicide. It might look perfect. There's still lots of things people take from it.
Well, it's quite amazing in that time that you've scratched that garden together from a dry cow paddock, really.
That's right. So there was nothing here literally when we came.
And it seems to me on a hill, so it's quite windswept.
It is very windy. I have a windmill which we put in, and it's not an ornament. It's because I figured if it's going to be windy 24/7, it might as well be getting the water out of the ground. So we do function on bore water, but our bore water is also salty, which is just what is part of life around this area. So there's no beautiful camellias or azaleas. I mean, not that I'm having the shade for them anyway. So the garden has to be pretty bulletproof. I am a bit of an obsessive compulsive gardener. You know, I live to garden.
Yeah.
And every now and again it quite perplexes me when someone says, well, what do you like to do for pleasure? It's like, oh, I like garden.
I'm always in the garden. It's a compulsive gardener in me, yes.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I'm always trying new veggies to grow. You know, I'm fascinated. Last year I grew 25 different sorts of pumpkins, and people say, why? And I said, well, why not? You know, they all were grown for a reason at some point. They all had different qualities. So I find it fascinating that sometimes people get in the same or boring rut of growing the same one thing.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, that they all, I only grow, you know, gross list tomato.
Yeah,
it's like, really?
Right.
Well, just spread out.
That's right. You know, and give it a go. And I'm always trying quirky, unusual vegetables. This last year I grew something from Peru and Bolivia called a chocha. And, you know, it turns out to taste sort of like a cross between a cucumber and a green bean. It's got an amazing climbing vine. It's a food staple, in that part of the world. And yet I love it. It's like tomatillos, you know, all these interesting veggies.
Oh, tomatillos are just the best bee's knees.
Oh, they're amazing. And my goal each year now is to try and produce as many tomatillos as I do tomatoes.
Oh, me too. I'm so glad that you're on my page.
Absolutely.
Tomatillos seem easier to grow.
I think they are too. They're later, certainly, for us. You know, the main harvest is at the end of autumn, whereas tomatoes are sort of a bit more all the way through summer.
Yep.
But they're fantastic and they freeze brilliantly. I'm just about to make tomatillo soup for dinner tonight.
I was just going to say soup
cake.
And salsas and all sorts of... And is that a Mexican vegetable originally?
Yeah, it's South America. So,
yep.
So it's the traditional base of salsa verde. But I find it interesting. If people have never eaten it, have a go at growing them. You have to have three plants because they're fully self-fertile. But they taste like a cross between a plum and a tomato-ish. But my favourite thing to do with them is you roast them until they just sort of collapse, and then you serve them with ice cream.
Oh, really? Oh, anything with ice cream.
Yes, big winner.
Well, that's interesting. I had a birthday, and my friend who is a horticulturist, he brought me seedlings for my birthday, which was the best present ever, and five tomatillos and five hillbilly tomatoes and quite a lovely range of unusual things. But it did show me, and I had these mountains of tomatillos, which I made copious amounts of that green sort of salsa verde.
Yes.
And it was so picante, so perfectly my taste buds. I absolutely loved it, but I didn't do the sweet side of things. I did the savoury side of things.
Okay. Well, the other thing is that last year we had a bit of a food festival and I had a chef in and she made salsa verde with both the fresh tomatillos and roasted, and they had totally different flavours. So when you cook tomatillos, they get a sweetness to them. So I use them a lot in curries and luxes, and they add that sweet and sharpness to a dish that is quite amazing. So, you know, if nothing else, and listeners are out there, try tomatillos. They're related to Cape Gooseberries, but actually I think they're easier to grow.
Oh, I do too. They've got the same sort of papery sheath as a Cape Gooseberry, don't they?
They do, like little lancers.
I think it's probably because Australia really had all of its sort of foundings in England that we just didn't sort of expand our minds to other flavours and other vegetables that would maybe be more contingent into our region and our climate.
Mm.
So it's interesting for gardeners to really set sail and find perhaps more interesting vegetables that are conducive to growing here.
Absolutely, and I also love vegetables for practical purposes. So, you know, let's say you need some shade on the side wall of your house and it's really hot and you just put up a bit of Rio mesh, you know, the builder's reinforcing mesh that goes in concrete footings. So one of my favourite things is to grow New Guinea beans. And it's neither a bean nor is it from New Guinea, but it's a climbing edible squash. And when you talk to people from different nationalities, you find this is a staple in virtually every food culture apart from our own.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Vietnamese call it bo, the Maltese use it, the Italians call it chuchuza, the Japanese use it, the Indians love it, they either call it lauki or duri. And it's this amazing vegetable. Again, I make cakes from it like you would a zucchini cake, and it's my favourite cake. But if you put it into, say, a curry or a laksa or a pho soup, whereas if you put a zucchini in, it would go to mush, these vegetables hold their texture. Now, I also add it to my juice in the mornings when I have a vegetable juice. And so, you know, there's so many different things. And when you grow New Guinea bean, because it's such a rampant climber, it'll grow up the Rio mesh and it will actually shade, say, the western wall of your house. So if you need some instant shade to keep your house cooler so you're not having to use electricity, it's a fantastic vegetable.
And that comes under a name New Guinea bean, is it?
New Guinea bean.
From Diggers or Eden Seeds or
Diggers
something?
Or Eden Seeds or Green Harvest. And
you'll actually
find it, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that here I am down in Frosty, the Adelaide Hills. You know, we go down to -5, potentially for 6 months a year, and up to 45, the hot weather. So we've got this dry heat, so I'm able to grow it. Yet if you go up to Darwin, they're able to grow it too.
Wow.
So it really is quite a hardy vegetable. But it is rampant and it's a climber. And the vegetable, the beans get up to over a metre long. I think the heaviest stuff I've grown this year was about 11 kilos.
What?
At maturity. But you don't harvest them to eat like that.
Right.
You dry them like gourds. They sort of, as they dry, they become like natural rain sticks.
Okay.
You harvest them between about sort of 30 and 60, 70 centimetres. and use them then. And they're actually quite, if you eat them raw when they're young, say 30 centimetres long, they sort of have a bit of a zucchini cross cucumber flavour. Nicer than raw zucchini. That's not actually something I like to eat particularly. But, you know, a really interesting veggie. So I'm a bit addicted to growing things. Whether it's veggies or ornamental.
Well, obviously coming to your garden during its open weekends is so inspiring because of all these unusual things that I didn't even know about, the New Guinea bean, which I'm totally going to grow. But it seems like you've been able to delve a community of like-minded people at these Sophie Patch events. Like there's beekeepers and creatives that come. So it just sounds like it's just, you know, bigger than Ben-Hur, so much of the local community coming to showcase things as well.
Well, it is. So when we started opening our garden a few years ago, because people had seen the evolution of the garden on TV, we always had in mind to have nurseries here, because to get good nurseries is getting harder and harder. So we have good nurseries here that represent the sorts of plants I grow, and they not only come here to get cutting material, but I go there to buy plants. So I have these nurseries here, and I also have diggers. The Diggers Club here is always here as well, and those nursery people do talks. We have a program of garden talks, so they do talks, whether it's on veggie growing for the season or fruit trees or whatever it is. So those nurseries do talks. But because I'm also involved with so many environmental, I guess you call them, societies, so for example, I'm patron of the beekeepers, so of course we have them here. We have talks on native bees. We have the Butterfly Conservation Society here, because within 12 months of me establishing some re-vegetation, I qualified as an official butterfly site. And so I've got them here. I've got Birds SA. You know, we've got all these. I often have basketry here too. So it's all these associated people. So when people come to our open gardens, it's not like a garden that you're in and out. Most people come for the day.
Yeah, well, you'll have to camp out and go the next day, I think. So much well, on.
We haven't yet started.
You do the Sophie's Patch campsite. I'm just flipping through your book, Sophie, and I see the New Guinea bean cake. It looks absolutely, and I can see the fruit there now, which I've never seen before. And I see a lovely recipe for the chocolate zucchini cake and the beetroot cake recipe as well.
Another interesting one that people are always fascinated by is green tomato cake. So there's a recipe in there for green tomato cake. Because at the end of the season, how many green tomato pickles can you make?
No, fried green tomatoes. They do get a bit boring.
They do.
Is that with sultanas?
Yes. So what they wouldn't need to be. You know, these
I love a sultana cake.
Can be adapted. And because we do the open garden and we have usually several thousand people through, they all want to eat something. And we just find it easiest if there are different cakes there that they can try. Then, you know, we try not to do the common old. Zucchini and beetroot are probably a bit common, but they're still great cakes.
Well, they're a great stalwart, really. And those big tray bake cakes are so great for feeding people en masse.
like
your five, fabulous five. So I also, the book is just so much full of practical information. Like if you're even starting just in a backyard, you'd get so much information from your book, just for the practicalities of how to start a veggie bed or no dig methods, etc., your favorite varieties. And if you had the luxury or the privilege for having a bigger property, there's just so much here for you. The flock of birds, obviously you adore them. They're like pets with benefits, I always say. It's nice to see your mixed flock. So what's in that mixed flock of yours?
So we have chooks, and they're for eggs and the manure. Both are wonderful, just don't get them confused. And then we have ducks, and they sort of came because originally someone said to me you could run ducks in your veggie patch. Now that is not true, but fortunately for the ducks, they're so delightful. I kept them on and they lived. So all the flock lives in the orchard. And then we have these, which are lawn mowers. Because I can't be, you know, I'm the gardener. We don't have a gardener here. It's me. My husband, you know, he does the building of things. So the geese help me maintain the orchard. They keep the grass down for most of the year, which is great. And they also make, not only do give you eggs, but of course ducks too, great cakes. And geese give you the most amazing eggs. The goose egg is extraordinary, fabulous for custards and
sort of baked
desserts. Oh, and when they're in season in spring, they are amazing. They're about the size, we count them as two chook eggs.
Okay.
If you use them in a custard, the best custard you'll, like a real custard that you make.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I've never had goose custard, goose egg custard before.
You're going to have to put it on your to-do list.
I will. So that's quite a big flock, isn't it?
It is a big flock, and we've also entered into the guinea fowl.
Oh, yes. What are the guinea fowl for? What do they do?
Well, the apart from being very cute. Manage pests outside of the orchard.
Yep.
But the problem with you can't have your flock in your garden, or they make such a mess and they devour all your veggies.
Yeah.
And someone, quite a bit of research, but obviously not with the right people, they told me that guinea fowl didn't scratch if you didn't raise them under a chook. They would manage pest problems in a garden, and they also are a good snake alert. So I got them primarily to manage cabbage white caterpillars on my brassicas. So I thought if I could get them to manage them, I wouldn't need to net my brassicas, because otherwise you have to net to get perfect brassicas. They did an amazing job of eating all the caterpillars, and then they decided they liked the brassicas too, so it's been a bit of a disaster.
So this is the mix, isn't it? This is the sort of balance that you're opting for, physical rather than chemical controls.
Absolutely.
Which is awesome, and, you know, and of course we can nut that out. We're gardeners. We're intelligent. This is what, you know, it's like a full-time process just to find the right solution for the problem. But I also, with my cabbage white butterfly problem, I integrate the Artemisia all through the cabbage beds.
Artemisia wormwood?
Yeah, like Powell's Castle, because I've got it, and I just chuck the cuttings in, like just do-do-do-do, right underneath all my brassicas, and the brassicas grow out of a cloud of Artemisia.
Wow.
And the Artemisia smells so gross, or it must have this repellent quality, that now I don't have to net.
Really? Because I have wormwood hedges all around my veggies.
I know, around, but integrate in, and then I think they don't come anywhere near it.
Oh, I'm going to have to try that, because I know, Jerry, see, it does depend where you live, and this is where you really have to experiment in your own garden. Jerry Colby-Williams up in Queensland swears by something called Glandcrisp, which is something that he plants between the cabbages, and apparently the cabbage white butterfly lays egg on that, and then when the caterpillar hatches, it gets killed by the Glandcrisp. But it doesn't seem to work so much in my garden.
Isn't that funny? I've never heard of that one.
You know, so it's all about trying to find what works, isn't it?
It is. It's about we tried it a couple of years ago, because someone just told me that, and I was like, okay, well, I've got plenty of Artemisia, I'll just like whack some cuttings in, and they all just struck, so that's what's so good with, I suppose, Artemisia. It's not like you have to go and really buy anything.
Oh.
Mind you, once you've got one plant, then you can just sort of pick off and just press them in. But then they all sort of grew in a cloud, so they've got this sort of lovely, soft, silvery cloud of Artemisia Powell's Castle, and then all of the brassicas sort of rising above it, and it does really work. And then for the next year, I just keep the Artemisia in, because the brassicas are such long term, you know, they take 7 months to grow. Try that one.
I will, thank you, Linda. And so they're growing Artemisia, it's not just pruning.
They're growing. Living. No, they've struck and all. They're going for gold. So those little something. Yeah, try that one next winter.
Thanks, ma'am.
Yeah, my pleasure. So what's your vision for Sophie's Patch in the future? I mean, do you just want to grow as much? Because I see on your wonderful Instagram feed that I think the orchard's now being netted.
It has been. So the reality is that probably should have happened a year or 2 years earlier than it did. But for the first few years when we were building, I thought there's no point in netting it because we're not going to get crops. And then by the time I said, yes, I want to net, it took longer to get the netting up than I'd hoped.
And it was probably quite an investment too.
It was.
It would have been huge. It looked like a very big net.
It is. It's a huge cage. But what we're hoping is that, you know, there'll be all sorts of benefits, like keeping feral birds from eating all my grain and other side benefits, and also protecting my flock from birds of prey, which will be another benefit. So the thing is that from this summer onwards, we will get all the fruit from our trees, which is very exciting. You know, then we'll work out what we do with this abundance.
We'll have to buy like 10 Vicola outfits and Fowler bottles for Africa. You'll have to get a Vicola system happening, because preservation will be the key, won't it?
Well, it will. We also have a big cellar, and I'm interested to, you know, in the old days, people would put a lot of stock in the cellar. So I have all my pumpkins and squash and, you know, I have zucchinis in the cellar for 6 months and all these sorts of things. So I'm interested to see what can just be stored in the cellar You know, in the old days, they would wrap apples with newspaper.
And roots like crops like carrots and in sand.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm interested to see that, and we may end up, also setting up a cool room. So we're just seeing, we want to understand what system will work best for us.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. And is Sherlock Hound still on the job?
He is. He's an adorable beast who gets up to lots of mischief. But fortunately for him, he's very cute. Yeah. And so we're pretty forgiving.
He absolutely looks so charming. I think he warrants a movie made all for himself.
That's right. Well, if people don't know he's a maremarin, so his job is to keep the foxes away. And if people haven't had much experience with a maremma, there was a wonderful movie called Oddball. And when I watched that movie, I thought, gosh, Oddball's such a goody-goody. Sherlock is up to mischief.
How old is he now?
He's about 5 years.
Okay, good. All right. Well, he's absolutely – and he does a good job at the fox.
We have foxes all around the property.
Do you?
Sometimes a meter from the front door.
Wow.
And, I came out and saw this fox, looking at me a meter from my front door, and I was quite surprised. But he protects the flock, so the fox doesn't go within the orchard.
Ah, okay. He does his job well.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I love him. So it sounds like the books read so beautifully, and it's lovely to see pickies of the children growing up in this idyllic lifestyle. Also so practical and got lots of interesting and practical information, not only in the garden but in the kitchen as well. And you've shared so many of those wonderful recipes. But I think the delight of your garden that makes it so truly unique is the sculptures. And it seems like to me it's a combination effort between your wonderful dreams and Richard's reality. Is that the case?
He would say that, the artwork is 95% perspiration, 5% inspiration, and I'm, of course, the inspiration. I'm very fortunate. Whatever I can dream up, if it involves metalwork, Richard can build it. So we do have a great combination there. The sculptures are, they're recycled, repurposed materials, not really expensive stuff that hopefully gives people inspiration in the fact that they might see something that someone might view as junk and be able to turn it into something creative.
Oh, I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I think more people should do that. I mean, repurposing things that are going to get thrown out and in such a creative way and creating wonderful sort of spatial areas with and colour as well, I suppose, too. I mean, I absolutely love that treehouse that looks like a bird's nest.
It's beautiful, isn't it? So, and because, a lot, any of the basketry stuff around our garden, that is what you call ephemeral art. It's not going to last. So the treehouse was woven from grapevines. As a matter of fact, Richard and the boys are off getting me a load of grapevines at this minute. So as the grapevines fall apart, I've got glory vine growing over it. So it will actually become a living installation.
Yeah.
And, people think, it's so nice of you to build it for your kids. I didn't build it for my kids. I built it for me.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Look, when we met, it was, I think, the year 2000. So it's way back. And we travelled a lot through England, Scotland and Wales. And your passion was, I remember two big things, roses and yellow-leafed plants, or golden-leafed. Everywhere we went, you were like, I was like, where are my sunglasses? That's hideous. And you were like, I love golden-leafed plants. And it really feels like you are so amazing with your rose knowledge. Like, you knew all the roses. And was that from growing up in the nursery with your parents?
My mother was a member of the Heritage Rose Society of Australia and used to go to conferences and all that. And I, more than just liking roses, I'm particularly interested in scented roses. So anything with a perfume, I'm in.
Oh, so you're still loving roses as much now as back in the day?
I've evolved, and my passion now, I do love perfume roses, but I don't have many doubles in my garden. My passion now is single roses.
Yeah, and funny, isn't it?
My favourite rose of all time is an ocean rose called Mutabilis.
Oh, me too. Yeah, I love that one.
And it's a big thing, gets 2 or 3 metres high. You don't prune it. It doesn't like to be pruned. And it has three coloured flowers on it.
It looks like clouds of butterflies have landed on it.
It does. And it's just so beautiful. And I also like some of the the single roses that are coming out of the UK that are bred to basically keep flowering whether you deadhead them or not. So if you're looking for a low maintenance rose, some of the roses that have been bred by rose breeders like Chris Warner, he's got roses like Eyes For You and For Your Eyes Only and Eye of the Tiger and Ashy. They've often got the word eye in it because they're a single rose with a different eye zone. And I know that the Diggers Club is a bit, you know, enamoured with his roses too, and they often sell his roses. But he's an Englishman who's just gone to singles. They're disease resistant, so you don't worry about spraying. And if you don't get around to deadheading, they produce a second crop of flowers without your input. And
I remember that Eyes For You.
Yeah.
And quite a lovely sort of, it just looks like a bit like a peony. Like it's just, it's really, it's got a deepest eye in the centre.
Yep,
and
that's right.
Sort of peachy apricot sort of tones.
That's right. And even as it ages, it goes to this almost greyish pink, which is quite beautiful. So that's a sort of semi-double, like two rows of petals. But some of his others are pure single. And, you know, they're quite extraordinary. So if anything, I have moved from loving the big showy doubles to loving the more demure singles. And many years ago, a famous rosarian called David Ruston said to me, Sophie, gentle people like single roses. And I responded to him that I'm the least gentle person I know, but I'll take it as a compliment anyway.
Isn't it wonderful how, well, this wonderful life of ours with plants, living with plants and our evolution through different phases, I think it's absolutely remarkable. And I love the fact that you now love single roses. In fact, I think so many people go on that route. Mm. You know, they go through the big blousy, big numbers, and then they come back to the simple little things in life that just are so sweet.
That's right.
Oh, look, Sophie, your new book is absolutely amazing. Well done. I love it.
Thank you.
Absolutely love it. It's just an absolute treasure on my bedside table at the moment. So if you need a little dazzle of little inspiration, check out Sophie's new book called Sophie's Patch and hop online to see that really buzzing Instagram feed of yours, Sophie. You update it all the time, don't you? It's a wonderful way of keeping together. So much more information to impart, and I really value your time today. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk with you, Linda.
If you're ever in the Adelaide Hills, it's quite an extraordinary place on earth. It's called Sophie's Patch and Hamlin Cottage. I think it's definitely time to find some time, head over to her on one of her lovely opening days. I thank Sophie Thompson so much for being my guest today. If you love this podcast, head over to iTunes and give me a review. It really helps to find gardeners and keep in touch. Give me a 5-star review and I'll love you forever. Thanks for your time today. Happy gardening and go safely.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.